For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Connect, solve painful problems, raise amazing adults, and have healthy families. Welcome to the Sean Donahue Show. Jordan and I do this podcast because we want your family to be close and connected. And we want you to feel empowered and equipped in your most important job, the most important job in the world. Let's go deeper than this podcast. Head to my website, parentingmodernteens.com, and get my email straight to your inbox. And when you're ready to go deep and get serious coaching from me, join me in my VIP membership. Parents are teachers, and every home is a school. So teach well, love well. All right. Let's have some fun together. Father's love, a mother's love, is incomparable. You know, words cannot describe it. Even poets cannot describe what we feel for our kids. And when our kids are thriving and doing well, like that feeling we get in our heart is just so heartwarming. It's such an incredible feeling of joy and pride and connection. And when our kids hurt, you know, we hurt. It's just hard to separate that hurt because we're just so connected. Today, we have a special guest. We've got Richard Capriola with Jordan and myself, author of The Addicted Child, A Parent's Guide to Adolescent Substance Abuse. And we're going to get to know Richard. Jordan and I are going to ask him all types of questions and learn more about his expertise of working in this with our kids, our sons and daughters, in this really sensitive, important topic. Jordan, I'm happy to have him here.
I'm happy to have him here too. And I think this is a time in many of our lives when you look at history, addiction is out of control. Right? It is causing families to crumble. It is really a huge threat. And, you know, this is a worldwide problem, but we're really seeing it felt in different neighborhoods all across the U.S. It's really sad, right? And many of us listening to this probably know someone who is going through this process, whether it's you, whether it's your family. So honestly, Richard, we're honored to have you, and we're glad to kind of bring up this topic because it's hard for a lot of folks to talk about it. Let's start off by getting to know your background. How do you have expertise in this field?
Well, first of all, thank you guys for inviting me to the program. It's a privilege to be here to visit with both of you today about this very important topic. I have a long history of working in both education and mental health. I actually started out in education as a school administrator for about 20, 30 years. Mm-hmm. And then I transitioned out of that career over into mental health, where I worked as a mental health crisis counselor in central Illinois. Mm-hmm. And then was offered a position at Menninger Clinic in Houston, Texas, which is a large psychiatric hospital that serves both adolescents and adults diagnosed with mental health and substance abuse disorders. I was hired as an addictions counselor. So I worked with both teenagers and adults for over a decade. Mm-hmm. And so many times I would sit across from a family and I would go through their child's history of using substances. What substances were they using? How early did they start? How often were they using these substances? And I would give them a diagnosis of what we now call substance use disorder. And the parents would look across at me and they would often say, I had no idea this was going on. Mm-hmm. Or if they did suspect their child was using a substance, they might say, I sort of thought something was going on, but I didn't think it was this bad. Mm-hmm. And what's important here is that these are very good parents. These are good parents doing the best job that they can do. They miss the warning signs because nobody told them what to look for. Mm-hmm. So when I retired from Menninger Clinic, I decided I wanted to write this book, The Addicted Child, A Parent's Guide to Adolescent Substance Abuse, to give parents the essential information about adolescent substance abuse, how drugs work in the teenage brain, what drugs are out there that parents should be aware of, what are the warning signs a parent should look for, and if you suspect your child is using a substance, what should you do? What assessment should you get done, and what treatment options are available?
Okay. Yeah, really related with you know, everything you just said there, but from someone who has been working with parents and kids and teens for 25 years, I definitely related to that part of your story, Richard, where you're like, yeah, I didn't know it was this bad. That is so common. I think, I don't know why that's happens so often. I'm going to ask you why you think it happens so often. Here's what I think happens so often is, you know, one of my clients, you think I'm not changing the subject, by the way, one of my clients, recently her teenage son, locked her in the garage. Jordan, did I talk about this last episode?
No, I've not heard this. Keep going.
So her son has got some pretty serious problems with defiance and anger and rage. And she's doing some disciplining with her son. So this young man has lost the privilege of using his cell phone. And the son is not used to being disciplined. And so as a way of raging back to her, punishing her, he's locked her without her, took her phone and locked her in her own garage while she was in the garage doing nice, lovely things for the son and her other kids before school. And she was so trapped in there, she had to use her Apple phone to call her other son to let her out of the garage. Isn't this a horrible story?
No, it's a good, I want to know why. Keep going, please.
Well, why? Because he said, if you're going to take my phone, well, then, you know, I'm going to take your phone. If you're going to do this to me, then I'm going to do this to you. Right.
Right.
And it's, I mean, that's a bad story, right? That's like abusive. That's like abuse to a woman locking. And she was in there for a while until she had to call. Yes. And the thing about this mom, she asked me, what do I do with this? Here's, I think what happened is that this isn't the first time this young man's done something like this, right? This is the 100th time. But when you are working with, when you're living with somebody who keeps acting out or keeps struggling in life or with harmony, with good choices, it just becomes like your new normal in a sense. It's like you become desensitized and then you talk to an outsider outside your house and you say, you know, that is really bad. Like your son should not be locking you in a garage. That's weird.
And she's like the parents are almost in denial.
Yeah, because you just get like worn down over the months and the years. It's hard to see how bad things are because you start getting used to it. That's my answer. That's my weird answer to the question that I'm about to ask you, Richard. Why do you think it's so hard? Why do you think it's so common for parents to say, you know what, I didn't know.
I think part of it is because when it comes to alcohol, drugs, and addiction, those are very scary topics for parents. And unfortunately, many parents have the attitude that this can't happen to my kid. This happens to other kids. This happens to other kids who live in other neighborhoods or different areas. So they sort of take an approach of, well, you know, it's sort of sad that this happens, but it would never happen to my kid. Yeah. And I can say that every child, every kid is vulnerable to being captured by alcohol or drugs. Every kid. It doesn't matter what school you send your kid to. It doesn't matter what religion you go to, if you do, or what church you go to. It doesn't matter whether you live in urban, suburban, or rural areas. Yeah. And it doesn't matter what your level of income is. All kids are vulnerable.
I have a quick question.
Yeah. Hold on. I want to ask a quick question because I think if you were to – I don't have the data set in front of me, but if you were to look at society, I could probably argue 80 to 90% of people are going to explore, right? Explore alcohol, explore drugs potentially. But my thoughts are people listening right now, maybe you grew up in the 70s, 80s, even 90s. I feel like the drugs today – are so much more potent. The fentanyl use is so much more addictive than it was when some of us were kids, to where as a parent now, I'm even fearful for my kid to even try anything because it could completely ruin their life.
Mm-hmm. That's an excellent point. And let's just take marijuana, for example. Yeah. The marijuana that was out there in the 60s and 70s, you know, during the Woodstock era, for example, is nowhere near as powerful as it is today. Back then, the THC level in marijuana was around 2%. 3%. Right. Today, it's 60, 70, 80% because of the way that it is grown. So even a drug like marijuana is so much more powerful now than it was when our parents grew up or when maybe we grew up. And then we have these drugs like fentanyl, which is out there that is being laced within drugs that kids get. And they're overdosing, not because they're looking for fentanyl. They're overdosing because they're out there looking for a Xanax, and they happen to buy it off the street, and it's laced with fentanyl.
Right.
So these drugs are much more dangerous. That's a good point.
I'm going to ask you a personal question right now, but I can't wait to the part of the podcast where I get to ask you, what tips do you have for parents if, you know, the first time they catch their kid with some pot in the house?
Yeah.
And do you have any tips or advice? And I'm going to give them my tips or advice too, because I've been in this space for a long time.
Yeah.
What's different about our space is that it sounds like you've worked with, you know, in the education or the schooling. So you got to see it from there. Then you transitioned over to a hospital. And my experience, my teams and I has mostly been in the home life, like literally in their home, yeah, working with the parents. So here's my next question for you. So I'm always curious, like of all the like fields that people could get into, why do they pick their field? Like for me, part of why I picked this field of working with families and parents is because of some childhood pain that I went through. And like, I wanted better for myself, for my family, for my wife, for my kids. And that pain of what I had to experience as a kid drew me into now being, you know, an advocate for healthy. So did you have any, is it a love for kids, or did you have any personal pain that kind of drove you to write a whole book and now be like an advocate for, you know, for this field?
What drove me to write the book was the pain that I saw so many families going through that had a child that was struggling with alcohol or drugs or maybe even a mental health disorder. I saw the pain that those families were going through. I saw the struggle that led up to it being such a crisis that they had to hospitalize their child to save their child's life. It had gotten to that point. And I saw the pain in their eyes and listened to them as they expressed that pain. And I wanted to try and whatever I could do, put a resource out there that might help parents not have to go through that pain and suffering that I saw so many times when they brought their kids into the hospital.
Jordan, how old are you right now?
37, 38.
Okay, you're 37,
one 38? Of them. I'm one of them.
Okay, so,
no, right, because depending on, I'll be turning 38 in like a couple months. So whenever.
All right, man. Listening. So in Richard's book, he shares some stats. And one of the stats, he says 21 years ago, the stats were much higher. So yeah, I've heard that many times. So kids were abusing substances more when you were 16, right?
Than they are now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, that's legit, Richard. People were experimenting more 16 years ago than they were now?
Well, the percentages are still ridiculously high.
Right.
Interestingly, during the pandemic, what we saw was a significant decline in adolescent substance use because kids were locked up, basically.
Huh. Okay.
And we now have a couple of years of data as a result of what happened after the pandemic. And what we're seeing is that the numbers are still below the pre-pandemic level. They haven't gotten back up to where they were before the pandemic, but they're still ridiculously high when it looks at, you know, marijuana use, when it looks at alcohol use, and when it looks at vaping, which is a new epidemic that's out there. Sure. Is kids now vaping nicotine and marijuana?
Oh, yeah.
You know, but, you know, for decades, you know, teenagers have been attracted to alcohol, marijuana, and tobacco.
Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe that's because awareness is getting out there about the dangers of these drugs. And so that's why it's down a little bit more. Maybe the pandemic helped families come together more. I would have thought the opposite. I thought people would have went crazy during the pandemic and explored more with drugs. But that at least gives me some hope that it went down a little bit. Maybe families are getting stronger together. I want to really get into like some stories of like how bad it can get and how you can help. And I mean, maybe we'll start with this question I have, Richard. Let's just start before we get into a story. What are some warning signs me as a parent can look for in my child, like right off the bat?
Well, what I advise parents to do is pay attention to the changes that you see in your child. You know your child better than anyone. So don't assume that some of these changes that you might be seeing are just normal adolescent acting out behaviors. They may very well be that, but they might also be an indication that there's something else going on underneath the surface that you need to take a look at. Some examples would be a child whose grades are declining, a child who used to enjoy participating in sports no longer participates in those sports, a child who used to introduce you to their friends now becomes very secretive of who their friends are, a child who becomes very secretive about where they've been and comes in at different hours. And then obviously, if you smell any odd odors or you find any drug paraphernalia in the house or around their rooms, those are obvious signs. So basically, as a general rule, pay attention to the changes that you see going on in your child and be a little curious as to why those changes are happening.
And then, Sean, my question for you is, if I notice that as a parent, how can I be the cool parent and get the information and not sound like I'm grounding them or being or judging them, you know?
Yeah, well, before I tell you my response to that, I'd love to get Richard's response, because this is a really important question.
How do I approach it?
Give us some tips, and I'm going to tell you some tips from after Richard goes. Based on what you've experienced, what are some do's and don'ts? What are some tips you have for parents who have, you know,
found
just
that
discovered,
out.
Found yes. out? Let's just go with pot.
Yeah.
Marijuana.
Okay. Let's start with what you don't do. Okay. You don't yell at the child. You don't criticize the child. You don't threaten the child. And you don't punish the child. Okay. So what do you do? Well, the first thing you should do is have a conversation with your child. And by that, I mean, don't do all those things I said don't do. Mm-hmm. And instead, you want to approach this conversation from an inquiring point of view.
Yes.
You want to keep the focus on you, not the child. And by that, I mean, you know, we're really good at listening to the words we say when we're talking. We're not so good at listening to the feelings behind those words. Mm-hmm. And that's a skill that every parent can practice and every parent can learn, so that when you're talking to your child, you're not just hearing their words, you're hearing the feelings behind those words, and you're reflecting back those feelings. So in this discussion, you want to keep the focus on you. For example, I suspect that you might be smoking marijuana, and that frightens me. I'm really scared of what might happen to you.
Great.
Can you help me? Yeah, can you help me understand why I'm so frightened by the fact that you might be smoking marijuana? So you keep the focus on you, and you invite your child to share with you.
That's good.
Very inviting tone.
That's very good.
Just focus on your own fears. Yeah. Now, I'm going to be devil's advocate right now, because you and I both know your average 15-year-old, your average 17-year-old. There's a lot of teenagers that are going to play ball with you, and there's a lot that are not. Like, you know, it's not, just leave me alone. It's not your business. It was just one time. It's not a big deal. It wasn't even mine.
Yeah.
You know what? So that's not okay. You're scared. Why? Don't be scared. It's one time. Don't freak out. Right. So what I mean, that's typical. I mean, that's going to be more than 50%, if you ask me. Yeah. What are you going to do when
you just keep at it?
Do
we just keep trying,
you know, or being, you know, in your book, you said you've got these phases, right? You've got stage one is pre-contemplation, which is denial. So let's just assume, as you write about, they're going to be in denial. They're going to be minimizing this and minimizing the parents' humanity. So what do you do in these situations?
Well, that's a discussion that's going to go one of two ways. It's either going to blow up and the child's going to become, just like you said, argumentative and defensive, or it's going to go the other way and you might actually learn some things you didn't know. But regardless of which way it goes, you want to keep the focus on you. Even if the child gives you those kinds of responses, you want to keep the focus on you and try to help the child understand that you're afraid, that you're afraid. Even one time use, you're afraid. But regardless of how that conversation goes, if as a parent you're still concerned, then you should get the assessments done that I recommend in my book, the professional assessments, to so that you as a parent have the information you need. You either rule in or you rule out whether or not there's a diagnosable issue that needs to be addressed and treated. So the next stage, get the assessments done that I recommend.
Let me give you some things that I recommend, and then you tell me if you like them or you don't.
Okay.
I think that there's two big categories that I really would recommend every parent really thrive in when you first discover your kid with POT, for example. And the first one is what we're focusing on right now with Richard, which is really good listening. Really good listening. And partly how you can do that is through validation. Mm-hmm. So you could ask them, so like, where did you get it from? Oh, I don't know. It's okay. You can tell me. Like, I really want to know. This is a choice you made and I love you. And so just know you can tell me. I'm going to respond well. I love you. I got it from this kid at the party. Okay. Okay. All right. So that makes sense. You were at a party or you were, you know, under the subway. So were you the only one doing it? No, we were all doing it. Okay. Well, that makes sense too. Yeah. That, you know, that you'd be doing it with these other kids. Thanks for telling me that. So did you buy it or was it for free? No, I didn't buy it. I'm not druggy. No, we're just doing it. I was just curious, Mom. I was just curious. All right. Yeah. Thank you. That really makes sense. You were curious. You know, I knew we'd be having these discussions at some time. So yeah, tell me more. Were you afraid? Was it scary? Was it kind of fun? What do you think about this?
I think that's a good approach. I think it does invite the child to, number one, listen to how you're feeling about it. But it's also some very non-threatening type of questions that get at the basics of what that child was doing, why they were doing it, and what they think about it. Now, that gives you some initial information. The next thing you've got to do after you have that information is, what are you going to do with it? What's going to be the next step?
Right.
Because at this point, you're not convinced that the kid's going to stop. You're not convinced that the kid's going to continue using. The only thing you know for sure is he's used marijuana or she's used marijuana.
Right. One of the things I'm curious about is if, you know, we as parents feel, you know, hopeless. We've done all that. We've tried. Yeah. We can't get through. They just keep. Do you have any recommendations? I mean, when do we know it's to the point where we need to seek professional help? When do we know that we need to check them in somewhere? Like you said, one of your clients had to get checked in the hospital.
Well, I think that if you suspect your child is using substances, and let's say they've confirmed to you that they are, they might be a little secretive about what they've been using and how often they've been using, and most likely they're minimizing it. I think that your next step is to get the assessments done from the professionals that I recommend, so that you get a professional assessment. And if there is a diagnosis of a substance use disorder, is it mild? Is it moderate? Okay. Is it severe? And then what's the recommendation? What are the treatment plans? Because for some kids, they might do very well in an outpatient program. For other kids, they'll do well in an intensive outpatient program. And then for kids, particularly the kids who have an underlying psychological disorder with the substance abuse disorder, they may do very well in a residential program.
What would be examples of that? You're talking, what would be some like examples of what you're referring to?
A dual diagnosis, for example, would be a child who has smoking marijuana and has a personality disorder, maybe an emerging schizophrenia disorder, maybe a conduct disorder, maybe depression, maybe some type of trauma, maybe high levels of anxiety. Mm-hmm.
So that's good. So you're thinking for those kids that are already struggling with their mental health and now they're deep into the drug world. Is this what you're saying? We've got to check them in.
they're most likely, after they've stabilized, most likely going to look at a residential placement where they will be in treatment for anywhere from 2, 3, 6 months or longer, where you can address both the substance abuse and the mental health disorder.
Let me tell you why I agree with you, and then let me ask you a really tough question. I don't mean to have my questions so tough. I've been in this space, and it's very messy, man. It's very complicated. So why I love that, and I'll get your opinion on that too, Jordan. Have you known anybody, or when you were a high schooler, that ever had to get checked into a place or go inpatient care? Because oftentimes parents don't know that's what it takes. You've got to just take the child out of their everyday life, out of their everyday school, away from their friends, away from their video games, and say, we need to get this child intense help. We need to give them a period of sobriety, get their brain fresh, and develop a plan. And that's one of the, you know, beautiful things that can come out of like a really good, you know, wellness experience or from a really good hospital experience. Jordan, what do you think about that? Taking a child out of a teenager out of their space and checking.
Yeah, you need to create, it's like when a child is throwing a temper tantrum, like I said on the podcast the other day, and how in certain moments when you're with like a big party and they're throwing, you have to create a stop mentality right now. Like everything has to stop. You have to remove that kid from the environment to get them to stop acting out. And that's, I think, what you're saying is like they're on cruise control. They've got their phones, they've got this, they've got their friends, and they're getting pulled in all these directions. And then they just get into a situation where you have to stop life in order to get things to move forward in a healthy method.
Yeah. And just listen to Jordan right there. I think we should have compassion for every parent that's ever been this parent that, you know, Richard's talked about. Is I didn't know it was that bad, because like you didn't know that here you are, your kid is, you know, smoking pot for a few months, and then all of a sudden you got somebody like Richard saying like, yeah, we gotta check this kid in like that. I didn't know it was that bad, right? That's like, that's intense. Yeah,
it is intense. And you know, I'm gonna ask kind of a weird question, Richard, but I always look at this and I'm like, you know, is this mental health issue, is it an excuse? Like, has this always been an issue? Are we becoming more problematic with what's going on with our brains because of the food we're eating, because of the environment we're in, because of the technology we have? Is it this huge excuse? Like, where does willpower come into play? Is that no longer a thing because these substances are too addictive now?
Well, we're talking about adolescents. So there's not a lot of willpower control with adolescents because their brains just aren't developed yet to that point. They're really struggling to have the kind of executive functioning in their brain that we as an adults have. In other words, the ability to weigh pros and cons and make a rational decision just isn't in that adolescent brain to degree that it is, say, with an adult. The other thing is that I think, sadly, we have a lot of adolescents who are struggling with underlying psychological issues that go undiagnosed. And in a lot of cases, these kids are using a substance to medicate that underlying issue. An example would be, I worked with a lot of teenagers that were smoking a boatload of marijuana. These kids were smoking multiple times a day. And when I asked them to help me understand why they were smoking so much marijuana, the number one answer that came back was, it helps me with my anxiety. It helps me with my anxiety.
Right.
So when you have a teenager who is using a drug, they stumbled into it. Maybe they heard about it from a friend. Maybe they said, here, try this. It'll help you with the anxiety. And they find out that it works. They're much more likely to stay with that because they're medicating that undiagnosed, untreated issue. Maybe it's anxiety. Maybe it's depression. Maybe it's trauma. Who knows what it is? But it's not treated. And they found a drug that works for them.
And that's part of the problem with today with drugs is like, first time I smoked pot was on a church snowboard trip, 1995. And I think this guy, Jason Burney, we're in the parking lot of this hotel in Utah. We're snowboarding and this kid drakes out some pot. And I wanted to be cool. I was a sophomore. I was like, yeah, I'll smoke some pot with you. And I didn't feel anything. I didn't like it. And thankfully, I think I only smoked pot maybe one more time until college. But back in the 90s, I don't think people were smoking pot because of their anxiety. I'm doing air quotes right now. I didn't know what that word was. Now you got all these kids that are smoking pot because it's fun, because it's cool, because they're connecting with their friends, because Joe Rogan smokes pot, because the rappers smoke pot, but also because of their anxiety, their depression. And that's where Jordan's like, question is really good. Like, I think it's really tactful. It's like, are they just making up excuses for why they're smoking pot? You know what I mean? It's like, I'm feeling sad. My daddy was mean to me and helps me with my stress. Right. That's where, you know,
excuse.
So, no, it's, we're trying to be sensitive here, but we're also trying to be realistic. Like, this is the
absolutely, you know, and the University of Michigan conducts a nationwide survey every year, been doing it for 30 some years or longer. And they survey adolescents in three different grade levels. They survey kids in 8th, 10th, and 12th grades. And that's how they get an idea of what drugs the kids are using out there and what's going on from year to year. But two of the questions that they ask these kids, I think, are really interesting. And the first is, how easy is it for you to get drugs? And overwhelmingly, the response that comes back from these kids is, it's no big deal. I can get these drugs. Over 80% of them tell us it's no big deal to find marijuana. I can get it if I want it.
Eighth graders? Tell me that's not eighth graders.
No, that's not. Graders. This would be the 12th graders.
Okay, and, thank God.
It's not eighth graders. Right. Although, although if you look at eighth graders, you know, 11% of eighth graders are vaping marijuana. 11%. One out of 10. Yeah.
That right there, let's sit on that point for a second, because I got so many points. I didn't even come back to some of the points. Here's something very helpful. I think, Richard, you're going to agree with this. Jordan, you may not be aware of that. The stats on adults who are alcoholics, I think the number is 15. Richard, you're so smart. You probably know this number. 15. If you start drinking around eighth or seventh grade, abusing alcohol, like on a regular basis, you know, you're sneaking out to the field, you're in the seventh and eighth grade, you're in the minority. Like, not that many eighth graders are doing this. But the chances of you then becoming an alcoholic when you're an adult go way up if you started in middle school. And so what I'm seeing now, and there's a big difference when I ask people who have kids who are, you know, have an unhealthy relationship with a substance, I'll always ask them, when did this start? Because that is, it's a lot harder to work with a senior in high school who started in seventh grade versus one that just started, you know, smoking pot like this year. What do you think about that take, Richard?
Almost a third of 10th graders are drinking alcohol. Almost half of 12th graders are smoking alcohol. And when we look at marijuana, almost 10% of eighth graders are smoking marijuana. Almost 10%.
And 30% of eighth graders. Okay. Let me argue with you for a second. Okay. Okay. And I like arguing. So if you don't, let me know. Okay.
No, that's fine. Go ahead.
Okay, man. Yeah. Okay. I'm not going to let you scare me or anyone with that number. It's not scary. 10% of eighth graders are drinking alcohol. Is that what you said?
On the alcohol?
Or was it 20?
Eighth graders?
Yeah.
Eighth graders is 15%.
Okay, 15%. That sounds scary. But are these eighth graders getting drunk every weekend? Maybe not.
Probably not.
Probably not.
Probably not.
Are they drinking
at parties?
Their parents at their parties in eighth grade. The good news is that if you look at 100 eighth graders, 15%, we're just going to call those the cool kids. Now,
okay.
okay. Cool kids.
No, not saying they're cool.
I know. We're going to call them that. I get it.
But
go ahead.
Help me with this, Jordan. But you were in that crowd. Jordan was in the cool kids crowd. And
not the drinking crowd.
But you were not in the drinking. You were in the athletic group.
Right.
So did any of your buddies start drinking or dabbling in the eighth grade?
I don't remember the eighth grade. No, I remember ninth grade. I remember people in my school in sixth, seventh, and eighth who were dabbling with marijuana and drinking, but they were abnormal.
Personal.
They weren't
question.
The typical.
You're so close with a lot of your high school friends because you and your wife are high school sweethearts. And well known. Those adults, you do not need to answer this if you don't want to. That now here you are, you're 36, 37.
37, 38. Thank you.
37, 38. The ones that are your buddies that are still maybe struggling with alcohol or substances, it's like, you know, they are still binging and it's still a little bit too much. Did
yeah,
any of them start in the ninth grade drinking a little bit too much or starting with substances?
Yeah. Yes. Right. Because I mean, you're basically saying time is on your side then. So if you start early, you're going to be looking for the next buzz. There's a term people use that marijuana is a gateway drug, and you have people arguing, well, no, it's not. But it's like, that's where you start. Alcohol is where you start. And then if you're looking for more, you go to the harder drugs, and you have time now through these 4 years of high school and maybe two more years of middle school to maybe get to cocaine or heroin, you know, some of the hard stuff, which some people did do that later, you know, later years in high school, but not a lot, but they started younger. Correct.
In the shift that I've seen, Richard and Jordan, over the last 20 years is that, you know, when I was growing up, it was like kind of the cool kids who were partying like in the eighth grade. And in San Diego was the skater kids. And I didn't want to hang out with them because they knew they were doing drugs and they were smoking. And it was like, yeah, stay away from those kids.
Yeah.
But nowadays, it's not necessarily the skaters. It could be the football players. It could be the cheerleaders. It could be the band kids. It could be anybody. It doesn't like – it's like when I was growing up, it was the druggies who did drugs. Now that's not the case anymore. It could be anyone doing drugs. What do you think about that?
I think that's a
similar
good,
to your experience, or do you
– I think it's a completely different world than what it was 15, 20, 30 years ago. I think, you know, these drugs have become more widespread. The second part of that question that they asked, the first part was, how easy is it for you to get drugs? Well, overwhelmingly, kids say it's easy to get drugs, whether it's alcohol or some other drug. Second part of the question is, how dangerous do you think these drugs are? And overwhelmingly, the response that comes back is, they don't think these drugs are dangerous.
Oh, really?
I gotta
they
sit
don't.
On that point. We have to sit
really?
On that point. I've got three questions. I got so many That's questions, but there's wild. Three. If I don't ask you, I'm going to be bummed at myself. Let me let Jordan go off on that.
No, ask him. I'm surprised.
No, go off on why you're so surprised right now, and then I'm going
to
make sure.
Well, because every radio station you listen to that has news, every news headline, it's a fentanyl death here. It's this was laced. It was, you know, kids, you know, it just seems like there's so much more potency in the drugs now that I would have thought these kids would be more aware of how dangerous they are. I bet you could take that same question to adults and you would have an overwhelmingly overwhelmingly, you'd have people agree that drugs are more dangerous now and that they would be more terrified of them now.
I don't think they care. I was like blown away about 10 years ago. I was working with this one teenager, a big old football player, great kid. And he started taking LSD. And I was like, what? LSD? Like, who takes LSD? Like that? Like, that's a thing? He's like, oh, yeah. Like, how long has it been around for? He's like, a lot of us football players and guys that hang out, we started taking about a year ago now. It's been around this city quite a bit. It's like, what are you talking about? They don't care that it's so dangerous. They just like the rush and the feeling.
Yeah, and you know, they don't think it's something that's going to affect them. Yeah, they may know fentanyl's out there, but they don't know anybody taking fentanyl. And
I don't know anyone. Right. I don't know anyone. You guys know anyone who's taking fentanyl? I don't even know what fentanyl is. You hear it all in the news. And here
yes,
I'm in this space.
I
don't even know, like, why would someone take fentanyl? It's like, why would someone take fentanyl, Richard? Why?
Well, you know, outside of a medical reason, because it is a prescribed drug for medical reasons, most of the deaths from fentanyl come from overdosing, usually with the fentanyl being laced within another drug that they're taking. Then they didn't know they were even taking the fentanyl.
Sean, what are your three questions you have for him?
I've never taken cocaine, but I feel like because cocaine is so prevalent in movies, on TVs, like I feel like I know, like, this is why people take cocaine. You know, it's very glamorized in movies, coke. So what do people feel on fentanyl? Like, what do they get? What kind of high is it? Is it like a high like pot Or is it a high like LSD? Is it high like acid? Is it Molly? You're going to the concerts? Is it just so cheap and you're just going to go so numb out?
Again, I think most of the deaths, the overwhelming number of deaths that come from fentanyl overdose are not because somebody was taking fentanyl. It's because fentanyl was laced within a drug that they were taking. They didn't know it was laced with fentanyl and they overdosed on the fentanyl. Nobody's out there looking for fentanyl. Fentanyl is a very powerful opiate, much more powerful than some of the other opiates that are out there. So when it comes to the adolescent population, you know, they're focused on alcohol, marijuana, tobacco, vaping.
Right.
Fentanyl is not even a topic that they discuss.
We're talking a lot about pot and alcohol right here, but gosh, if our kids get involved in Xanax, Xanny bars, or prescription medication, gosh, that's what, like, my generation grew up with, Jordan. Like, I was going to parties and people were starting to pop pills, and like, no one ever told me it was bad to pop pills. I didn't, because I heard it. Just like somebody once told me, yeah, don't mix alcohol. But like, you know, a lot of people in our generations, Jordan, I went down that path of prescription medications.
Richard, do you have a Sean, hopefully we can ask him, you know, like, to talk a little bit about a story of someone who was maybe really bad, who actually you saw got out of it, was able to give people hope?
A great story.
Well, I saw a lot of kids, some women that immediately come to mind, who were in the adolescent treatment program at Menninger. And they stayed with us for 3, 4, 5 weeks undergoing treatment. And because of the severity of their mental health and their addiction, they went on to a residential placement after that for anywhere from 3 to 6 months or longer. Wow. And I worked with them when they were at Menninger. And then later I heard back from some of them, particularly one young girl who I worked with at Menninger, went on to a residential placement, successfully completed her treatment in residential placement, went on to college, successfully made it through college and graduated, and now is working as a career. So that was a great rewarding experience that I was able to witness and sort of help me understand that, yes, you know, recovery is possible, success is possible, with treatment and family support, you can overcome these things and go on and lead a very profitable, very beneficial, rewarding life.
So on
the other hand, one of the saddest experiences that I saw was a young girl who came into treatment whose boyfriend had managed to get her addicted to a very powerful opiate. I think it was heroin. And she was pregnant. There's not much we could do with her because of the severity of her addiction and the complications of her pregnancy. So we basically stabilized her in the hospital and then referred her to an inpatient treatment program to get her the help that she needed. But that was probably one of the saddest experiences that I saw.
That's terrible.
Here's a quick little great little story. I don't know if I've told this on the podcast before. I'm just going to make a really great long story super short. I started working with this girl. I'll call her Eileen, and she was a sophomore, really skilled soccer player, had really good grades, and just talk about a change of behavior. It was so drastic, and it just seemed like she was sneaking out. She was smoking pot, so I started working with her and her family in person. And this girl was just very volatile, very defiant. And I started suspecting there's something else going on here besides pot. And so I really encouraged her parents to do some drug testing. She refused, so they had to do it a sneaky deaky way. I've got lots of skills for y'all if you're listening to this, of, you know, how to work with your child if they're defiant, they're refusing therapy, if they're refusing sobriety. There's so much you can do. lots of tricks. And unfortunately, then she came back positive for Xanax. And what I think a typical Xanax prescription, I believe, is a 0.25 milligrams. It's pretty typical. Does that sound right to you, Richard?
It sounds about right.
And it's an anti-anxiety. And thank God they are not giving this to kids anymore. If they do, they're training the kids and the parents how addictive Xanax is. But what happens is that what kids in college-age kids do and adults is they abuse Xanax. Ready for this, Jordan? A Xanny bar. 2 milligrams.
Oh, wow. Is that like what they would take for their anxiety?
That's eight times. And you get so high, you can be high for like 24 to 40 hours on one Xanny bar. And some of these kids, including her, call her Eileen, she would tell me she's popping 2 at a party. And so I'm meeting with her, and she's clearly high on Xanax. So what do? We go through this crazy process because in the state of California, Richard, you probably have different laws there in Texas. You cannot force a minor into rehab in California. You cannot even force a minor to therapy here in California. Did you know that? Isn't that crazy town? Right?
Oregon's
so talking about treatment and putting your child into treatment. Well, can't we've got to come in through the side door here and do a lot of other stuff here in California. And here's what happened. So she was 5150'd. So she's in police hold in the hospital. You ready for this?
Why?
Because she was so out of control, talking about, you know, hurting herself, running away, killing her family. Okay. She was like, you know, having an episode, right?
So they arrested her.
So under my coaching.
Watch. Yeah.
We 5150'd her, which is involuntary police hold, or 5450.
Okay.
So now, thank God, she's in the hospital, because that's the only way you can hospitalize a minor in California is by using a 5450. But they can only hold her for a period of time. And now you're putting into your child in the hands of these doctors. And in most situations, when I say most, we're talking 80 to 90%. This is what the doctors say. Oh, yeah, they're a lot better now. You got to take them home.
Okay.
No, this is a fact. I've been doing this for 20 years.
I believe you.
I want to swear right now. I'm so pissed off.
Right.
This is what
happens.
They
don't want the weight on their shoulders. They just want to pass them on. Yeah,
they want to pass them on. They don't know what to do. They're unskilled.
Right.
Unless this is a graphic image, but unless somebody has taken a blade to their wrist and there's blood coming off, it's really hard to get your child treatment. And they don't specialize in 5150. They're not specializing in drugs there. They're just dealing with suicidal ideation, right? So this is a really – should I tell this story? Should I tell this story? I think we should. I don't know if I should tell this story.
Do it.
I don't know. Okay. So here's what we did. This is a very, very – I don't know if I should tell this story. Okay.
Okay, maybe not. Maybe don't tell
it. I'm going to do it. We can edit it out later. If you don't think it's a good idea, I'm going to rely on Jordan's wisdom and I'm going to edit it out. So we packed up the family, including the siblings, packed up her belongings into garbage bags.
Okay.
Black garbage bags.
Mm-hmm.
And the family drove 2 hours to the hospital and asked me to come. And oh, it was horrible. It was horrible. We arrive and she's cussing me out. Why the hell is this guy here? And the doctors and the nurses are like, what are you doing? Aren't you here to take her home? And the family felt like this was the best decision for their daughter, who has clearly had a serious disorder with Xanax. He said, we can either take you to a facility on your own will, or we're not taking you home. We will drive her anywhere else you need to go.
And how old is she?
Your belongings.
How old is she?
15.
Yeah. Okay. So you came down to an ultimatum.
Mm-hmm. And she said, I'll go to rehab. And unfortunately in rehab, she, in Santa Cruz, California, there's a lot of heroin. And so she discovered heroin and some really bad men who did heroin, and bad things happened in rehab.
Oh.
And she got now addicted to heroin.
Wow, that is awful. In rehab, the place you take them to hope to fix them.
So now she's in and out of rehab, but at least she's in the system and she's got some place to stay, you know, a free rehab. And she's not living at home. and she's in and out, and she did the hard work she needed to do. The parents did the hard work she needed to do. And about 2 years ago, she contacted me and she said, I've been clean and sober for many years. I've got a beautiful, healthy daughter and I'm doing great. And I want to start a business. I want to do what you do, Sean. And I want to help people. How cool is that?
That's great.
Wow. That's great. That's a great way to end the story when it could have gone any other direction.
Right? I know. And I was just so, my heart was just overflowing with joy and happiness. Looking at this beautiful woman who's like 25 years old and just thriving as a server. And
you know what's sad though? That fork in the road with the trash bags and you can either go here or here. There's a lot of people listening that maybe have had that ultimatum and the child has decided to go somewhere else. And it's maybe gone down the deep end. It's just so hard when you feel like you can't help or you're in a state that won't allow you to check them in. And you just
enable
as a parent, your ultimate goal is to keep them safe and to raise this child to be a full functioning adult. And then, you know, there's a period where you feel like you failed.
Yeah. I never met a child, a teenager who was admitted into our hospital who wanted to come into the hospital. Yeah. They were arguing, they were mad, they were angry. But the parents had gotten to the point where they felt as if they had no alternative. And then they would work through their anger. And within a week or so, they settled into the treatment program and made progress.
I was a little upset at you when I was reading page 78, man.
Richard, if it's just one page, that's okay.
It pissed me off, man. It made me upset.
All right.
Because you write this sentence about hope.
Yeah.
And it's not long enough. I just felt like I wanted to come in there and be your co-author and write some flowery language because this is what he writes. Research shows that treatment can work even if it's mandated or entered into unwillingly.
Period.
Outcome studies, period. That's an amazing sentence, man.
Well, that's
I'll read two more, even though I'm mad at you.
That's the bottom line. It works.
Chapter on hope. Outcome studies from court-ordered treatment placements show mandated treatment can work. Most studies suggest the outcomes for those who are legally pressured to enter treatment are as good or better than outcomes for those who enter treatment without legal pressure.
Yep.
That's amazing. That's amazing. It makes me wonder why California and Oregon and some of these other states won't do that. It's weird. But because you're right, who wants to go to those locations that they don't want to stop what they're doing. They're having a great time in their life.
What you're talking about here is not enabling. This is don't not judge this parent who showed up with trash bags because this is what the book is not about, how to not enable. That is a whole different thing. If you are struggling with enabling, then do some work on yourself. Contact me. Go to some Al-Anon meetings. But I do have three questions I have to ask you because I don't know. We don't have much more time together. But I have to ask you a question. Are you ready?
Sure.
All right, man. It's something I alluded to 30 minutes ago. Okay. Let's say you catch your kid with some pot.
Yeah.
And or, you know, a flask of vodka. And you're doing all the good listening because I said about 30 minutes ago, there's two big categories you got to excel in that moment. My question for you is, what else do you do besides good listening and good connection, good communication? Because we agree that is one part of it. But your response to my listening validation was really good. I don't know if everyone remembers Richard saying this. He said something like, yeah, that's good listening, but that doesn't solve any problems. The kids could still be on a bad path or, you know, could not have a problem. So I got a couple of tips that I want to share our audience of what I think they should do in that situation. But can you go first? And Jordan, go ahead too. Any tips you guys have? What could you do after you listen to your kid, what should they do next?
Get an assessment done from a professional. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not the professional. You deserve as a parent to get some expert advice, get a psychological assessment.
Where can they find these professionals? Because your local therapist is not a professional for drug disorders. Yeah. Where can they find them?
I would recommend you start by talking to the school counselor, the school social worker, or the school psychologist. They're all going to be free. So you go in and you talk to them. You tell them what your concerns are. Many of them are trained and able to do some of these assessments on their own. Or if not, they can refer you to professionals in the community that they've worked with who can get these assessments done. At a minimum, you want to get an addictions assessment. And you want to get a psychological assessment to rule in or rule out if there's any psychological issues that you need to be addressing.
Really good answer.
But the bottom line is
pro.
Yeah, talk to a pro, get those assessments done.
Jordan, I think you know what I'm about to say next. So, all right. What happens if your salty teenager is not going to go to those meetings, man?
They're not going to want to go.
I'm not going.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're the parent. You know, it's not going to be the first time your child told you no. You're the parent. They have to go.
Coming out. That's a boss right there. He's like, get it done.
They have to go.
They got to go. Yeah. I've always
tried to give my kids like a voice so that they felt like they had, you know, decisive powers, you know, like, oh, I'd like to do this. No, I don't want to do that. Okay. You know, I respect that. And one time I was having a problem with my kids wanting to go to church. I was like, Sean, what do I do? And you're like, dude, your kid's 7. Of course they don't want to go to church. You just take them to church. I'm like, oh, okay. Okay. That makes sense now. Thank you.
All right. Here's what I love about what you both just said. And let me add my coaching to this, to anyone who's listening. I think for a lot of parents that just heard Richard, I can't speak for every parent, Richard, but I think a lot of parents are like, dang, that's a lot. That's kind of intense, man. For a little pot, a little flask of tequila, like, you know, that sounds intense. Do you think that would be a common response, Richard, or do you think I'm a little off?
Well, I think parents tend to minimize or run away from the fact that their child might be using more than what the kid admits and is a parent. Do you really want to run that risk?
Hell yeah. I was hoping you'd say that. I knew you would because I read your book. If you're talking about do's and don'ts, you cannot minimize this. Here's why. If you come home and if you see a kid, he's got abusing a substance, and if you minimize it, he's like, you know what? No big deal. Okay, you say you're not going to do it again. Okay, no big deal. Or, okay, oh, you smoke a little pot? You know, I smoke a little pot too. You know, at least it wasn't on a church trip. Like, right? And then you minimize it. You're really sending a message to your child you do not want to send. They are playing with fire here. Like, if you are out, I've been using this rifle analogy recently for some reason, Jordan. Like, if you're out there and you're hunting, and you have a rifle and you're a teenager and this person makes a bad choice with a rifle, mm-hmm. like you have to freak the hell out.
Right.
Like this is not okay. You can never, ever do this again. This is a rifle.
Right.
You know what I mean?
We just had that situation where my son left the window open upstairs and I have a son, Richard, who has special needs. So when our older son left the window open, he could have fallen out the window. And there was a moment we had to create that shock and that awe to it scared him. But I'm glad I scared my oldest son so he won't do that again.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dude, that's funny. I have a window too. And the bed is up against the window.
Yeah.
And my daughter was leaning against the window and I'm thinking her or her friends could easily fall through the window to their deaths.
Yeah.
And it scares. Thank God that bed is moved away from there. But the shock and awe needs to be a part. And how you do that shock and awe, I think is got to be, we could do a whole nother episode.
It's sensitive. Yeah. You would know more than anybody because you've had to do it. Maybe Richard, you have had to do it too.
Don'ts.
I wouldn't know what to do.
Weird shock and awe where you're like scaring the kid or. But you do. But like, it's like, what do you think? Shock and awe. Because what you're talking about is getting assessment. That's a big deal, man. That's shock and freaking awe.
Yeah. Yeah. But it has to be done.
It has to be done.
You don't want to miss anything. You want to know what's going on. And it's like anything else. The earlier you see the warning signs, the earlier you get an assessment and a diagnosis, and the earlier you get treatment, the more likely this is not going to become a life-threatening problem.
It's such a dance, though, gentlemen, because if you do that shock and awe and you're too weird about it, if you're over the top –
Yeah.
Well, then the fear is that your kid is not going to tell you the next time.
Right. Yeah.
It's going to push them into secrecy or to shame.
Correct.
And so, right, we need a whole episode for how do you respond the first time your kid brings pot home or a flask or a vape with nicotine in it. Because your kid's not going to come home with LSD or cocaine the first time. Right? It's going to be something like that, right?
Right. Makes sense, man. It makes sense. It's hard that we have to have this conversation and talk about stuff like this. But the reality is that more and more of us need to have the conversations like this so that parents know that they have choices. A lot of us feel like we don't have choices.
Let me leave you with one tip.
Yes. And I'm going to leave everyone with one tip, Jordan. One tip.
Okay.
Tips.
One tip. So what works with these kids? What works with these teenagers when it comes to drugs? Well, I can tell you what doesn't work. In my experience, when I was working with them, it didn't do me any good to tell them drugs were illegal. It didn't do me any good to tell them if they kept using, their grades might decline. They might not graduate. Yeah. They might not go to college or get a job because they didn't believe it. But what did work? What worked was when I switched the discussion to a neuroscience approach. Ooh. These kids were smart. Mm. They were curious. They wanted to learn, and they wanted to learn about their brain. So when I switched the discussion to a neuroscience approach, what the brain does, how it works, and what drugs do to the brain, they became interested. That got their attention. I have a couple of charts in my book that you might have seen. One is a picture of the brain, shows the different areas of the brain and what they do. And the other one shows where marijuana attaches itself in the brain. When I showed that to these kids,
that's cool, man.
They immediately saw how marijuana works within the brain and how it affects the brain.
Well said, dude.
That captured their attention. Well they were said. Interested in that.
Yeah, you brought the science into it.
Yeah,
exactly.
Jordan, exactly. I just found out what the word psychosis means like 7 years ago. Do you know what psychosis is?
No.
Yeah. So look it up after this. Google it, because the adult brain can actually handle pot at a pretty decent, much better level than the childhood brain. And what you're referring to is one of the things that we can't find. A research report recently came out. Correct me if I'm wrong on this, Richard, is that the chances of a young man developing psychosis if they're a marijuana user goes way up. And I've seen psychosis in teenagers. It is not okay. It is bad. And so what you're referring to is just help them understand the impacts of the brain. Well said, man.
Before we get to Sean's, is basically I can see with my kids is basically Richard, you alluded to this earlier, is bring the conversation away from them and bring it back to me or myself or my family, or in this case, it'd be my wife. I could see my wife's relationship with my kids. They care deeply about how she feels. So if she were to come to them and say, you're going to do what you're going to do, but just so you know, when you do it, this is how I feel.
Yeah.
Maybe that'll trigger a response, make them think, oh, I don't want to make my mom feel this way.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point.
I've got a lot of tips. But I'm gonna go on one, and I think mine is gonna be a little bit similar to Jordan's. A lot of the research I've led around drugs and addiction has to do with the word bonding.
Okay.
Or if you think of like we're bonded to this person, we actually get bonded to TV shows, we get bonded to brands that we like to go to, we get bonded to restaurants. When you get bonded, it means like you feel like you can trust that person or that thing to be there for you. So like, you know, you can turn on, if you love the Office TV show, you can turn on Office and you can trust that it's really going to show up with a good episode. Or you can go to your favorite shoe brand and just trust that it's going to fit your shoe very well. And one of the best antidotes for substances and bonding to unhealthy things and people is family, is nurturing and tightening the bond of a family. And this is beautiful truth that research has shown that deepening the family dynamics, the connections, the closeness is very, very helpful in someone breaking an addiction. Is that true? Can you echo that, Richard?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yes, I was right.
Okay. I was like, okay, am I right?
Well, and that brings up one other point that that often we neglect the family when we're dealing with a teenager who has a substance abuse disorder. All the attention gets focused on the kid, and we forget to remember that parents need support too. They need help. This is going to be a journey, and parents deserve to have the support. Maybe it's a support group, maybe it's a friend, maybe it's a church, whatever it is.
Yes.
Parents need to have a support group.
Yes.
Yes.
Smart. And if you are that parent, and if you need support, whether you're support in raising a challenging child, or you are struggling in this system or in this cycle of substances, just know that I'm here for you. You can reach out to me. You can book a free consult call with me. And if you are wanting to go deeper, Richard, tell them where they can find you. I'm holding your book in my hand right now. Where can they find you?
The book is The Addicted Child, A Parent's Guide to Adolescent Substance Abuse. It's available on Amazon as both a Kindle and a paperback. It's available through the book's website also, which is www.helptheaddictedchild.com. There's some blog articles that you might find interesting, one of which is 10 questions that you can ask your child to check in on their mental health. One of those questions is, you ask your child, if your feelings were weather, what kind of a day would it be outside? Mm-hmm. And that's just a simple way of engaging the child and maybe getting a discussion and some feedback going on.
Richard, I really like you. You're just a really good-hearted, very smart man that's been loving kids for a long time. So thank you for loving our sons and daughters. Jordan and I are very, very grateful for you. Thanks for joining us today.
I appreciate you guys. Have a great week, and thank you for inviting me to your program and for all of your great insights and comments.
Thank you so much for joining us today. You are a good parent. Oh my gosh, family life and parenting is so hard. I hope today gave you some tools and some inspiration. And if you're enjoying this podcast, then please do me a favor. Leave us a positive review on your podcast provider. And if you're hearing this and you're struggling as a parent, your family is struggling, or you need parenting tools for that one challenging, struggling kid, well, I will see you in a live Zoom call inside my VIP membership, and I will give you the specific tools you need to solve every problem you have and to stay strong, be close, and teach wisdom.